In this weekend episode, three segments from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program this week. First, a discussion with Democratic Congressman Derek Kilmer and Republican Congressman William Timmons, the chair and ranking member on the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. They talk about the committee's final report to make Congress more effective, efficient, and transparent. Then, Jonathan Bidlack, director of the governance program at the R Street Institute, a center-right think tank in Washington, discussing government spending and upcoming fiscal deadlines facing Congress. Plus, Kiara Johnson, executive of the National LGBTQ Task Force, discussing the Respect for Marriage Act and other public policy issues impacting those who identify as LGBTQ. First, the leaders of the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress, Democratic Congressman Derek Kilmer and Republican Congressman William Timmons.
Let's talk about this committee. Why was it even created? What was its goal?
Yeah, about every 20 or 30 years or so, Congress realizes that things aren't working the way they ought to, and they create a committee like this. As you mentioned, we're called the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. It's been nicknamed the Fix Congress Committee, and it was really given the mission of just trying to make Congress work better for the American people. The genesis of this was about 4 years ago, as a new Congress was coming in. There was a lot of discussions about potential changes to rules, and as those discussions were underway, members on both sides of the aisle recognized that some of the problems that bedevil Congress as an institution aren't just about rules. They're around things like, how do we make sure that Congress as an institution can recruit and retain and have talented and diverse staff? It's about things like, how does Congress use technology in a way that actually serves the interest of our constituents? It's about how we have a more collaborative culture in the institution. And so our committee was set up to really grapple with some of those issues, to make recommendations on some of those issues, with the goal of then making some reforms within the institution so that it works better.
Congressman Timmons, define modernization.
Well, as the chairman said, we haven't done this in 20 or 30 years. So much has changed. The internet, technology, and really we're just trying to make the institution work better for the American people. It's got to be more efficient, more effective, more transparent. And we're using a lot of technology to implement best practices that everybody uses in their daily life, but Congress doesn't. Whether it's something as simple as using PDFs to digitally sign documents. I mean, this is serious. We're trying to figure out how to get Wi-Fi into our district offices. So it has been an incredibly rewarding experience, and I think the American people will be much better off for it.
Is it bipartisan?
It is very much bipartisan. So we're the only committee in Congress that has equal number Republicans and Democrats and require a supermajority vote. So we literally have to work together. And it has been an incredibly rewarding experience. We've built relationships. We've engaged in in-depth policy discussions, and we've gotten results. 202 recommendations have been made. We've been implementing along the way, so still got work to do. The committee's coming to an end, but I do believe we will continue the work of implementation in the next Congress.
Yeah, 42 have been fully implemented. 87 have been partially implemented. Chair Kilmer, so how have you come together? And, you know, Congressman Tim was just talking about you require a bipartisanship. There's not more Democrats on this committee or more Republicans.
Yeah, that was intentional. When the committee was established, there was a recognition that if you're going to make durable reform, it has to be bipartisan. Otherwise, it's just going to flip back and forth every time Congress hands over gavels to the other party. And as a consequence, we just decided if you want things to work differently in Congress, you have to do things differently in Congress. So what does that look like? Well, when we started up with this committee, the first thing that happens is the committee gets its budget. And with every other committee in Congress, you do simple math. Democrats get their half of the money. They usually use their half to hire people with a Democratic background who put on blue jerseys. Republicans take their half of the money. They hire people with a Republican background who put on red jerseys and then spend the rest of the time fighting with each other. Our committee didn't do that. I reached out to my Republican counterpart, Tom Graves, in the first Congress, William in this Congress, and said, so here's a crazy idea. Why don't we just have one staff? Some of them will be Democrats, some of them will be Republicans, but they'll all put on jerseys that say, let's fix Congress together. And that is very unique, but it was fundamental in terms of the culture of our committee. If you watch one of our, I always tell my constituents, if you watch one of our hearings on C-SPAN, one, you may have too much time on your hands, but two, if you do watch one of our hearings, you'll notice a few things. One, we don't sit with Democrats on one side of the dais and Republicans on the other side of the dais. Why? Because when we hear a witness, my genetic predisposition is to lean over to the person next to me and say, hey, that was kind of interesting. What do you think about that? In our committee, when you do that, you do it to someone from a different party, and it engenders dialogue. We don't even sit on a dais. We sit around a round table. Why? Well, I don't know about you. I have never had a good conversation speaking to the back of somebody's head. And so we sit around a big round table. We're able to actually make eye contact with our colleagues when we're discussing these tough issues. And that's not cosmetic. To William's point, the consequence is we've been able to, with support of both Democrats and Republicans, pass more than 200 recommendations, all of which were bipartisan and all of which were, I think, important as we try to make a Congress that works better for the American people.
I'll have you both give us some biggies that you have, some big changes that have been made. I'll start with you.
Sure. You can sort of go issue by issue. Staffing is a really big deal. The amount of turnover in the institution has been very significant. And as a consequence, it's sort of a brain drain. When people say, gosh, Congress seems to be struggling to solve big problems, part of the reason for that is you've seen this sort of frequent, almost lobotomization of the institution as talented people leave. And so when you watch, for example, the social media hearings and it looks like Congress is getting outgunned in those dialogues, it's because Congress is getting outgunned in those dialogues. So we made a number of recommendations focused on how Congress as an institution can do a better job of recruiting, retaining, and having more diverse staff. Some of that's around things like being able to compensate staff better. Some of it's about actually having some HR capacities within the institution. Congress is a very unique body in that it's sort of 435 independent contractors all doing their own thing. We tried to provide some centralization, at least of best practices, so that offices could do a better job of hiring and onboarding their staff. Setting up some professional development opportunities, some training opportunities for staff was also a big deal. So that's one chunk. I'll mention one other, and then I'm sure William has some thoughts as well. We were not assigned the topic of looking at issues related to civility and collaboration, but it became very clear when our committee was doing the work that one of the big impediments to progress is just the amount of conflict in the institution. And we talked to political scientists, and we talked to management consultants, we talked to organizational psychologists. I thought about consulting with an exorcist to think about how do we make this institution a place that, you know, is focused on progress, not on, you know, the Jerry Springer show. And the good news is we actually made a number of recommendations. I'll give you a quick example because it's happening right now. When I talked to an organizational psychologist, at the end of that discussion, he said, I've got a sports coach you should talk to because he took over a team with a really bad culture and turned it into a winner. So I called this football coach and I said, what do you do when you got players on the team who are actively trying to sabotage the team? He said, well, I cut them. I said, well, we don't really have that option. And he said, well, then I bench him. And I said, we don't have that option either. And he said, I have a question for you. He said, how do you onboard new players? And I said, well, we don't really have players. I said, but we do have orientation when new members come on. We're doing it right now. There's new members who are here getting oriented to the institution. And he said, how does it work? And I said, you know, it's funny you ask that because it works entirely the wrong way. You literally show up to orientation and they say, Democrats, you get on this bus. Republicans, you get on that bus. The entire orientation process is designed to keep the two parties apart. And he said, well, Derek, I don't know much about Congress, but it seems like you ought to stop doing that. So one of our recommendations was stop doing that. Actually have an orientation process that tries to engender dialogue and discussion and collaboration between the two parties and relationship development. We have about a dozen recommendations in that space, all focused on trying to figure out how do we have some intentional just change up of incentives to get Democrats and Republicans at least to try where they can listen. The two parties have a lot of disagreements on a lot of issues, but I think one of the things that frustrates the American people is oftentimes the institution doesn't even seem capable of moving forward on things on which there is agreement. And so we've made a number of recommendations in that space that I think could be game changers over time.
Congressman Timmons, some biggies from you.
So the calendar and the schedule has been the area that I focused on the most. In 2019, we were in D.C. 65 full days, and we traveled 66 days. So we're literally in the airport more than we're working. And that's just not a way to run the place. So we recommended that we change the schedule to be in D.C. more. And then when we're here, we need to deconflict the schedule. The biggest challenge is average member serves on 5.4 committees and subcommittees. And We also have floor votes, we have constituent meetings, we have fundraising. We ping pong all over the Capitol complex, and we're never where we need to be to do our job. We need to legislate. Committee work is incredibly important, and I've been on three committees in the last 4 years, and rarely is there more than three or four people, 10% of the committee in the room when I get my chance to speak, and it's because everybody has so many overlapping obligations. So deconflicting the calendar and the schedule has been incredibly important, and we have seen a lot of progress there. Hopefully next Congress we're going to have a common schedule for committee calendars, and that is the first step to then really understanding the challenges that members face and where we can streamline the calendar to allow people to be in their seat in committee.
How does a common calendar work?
So we're still working on that. We've got requests for proposals out from the clerk's office. And at the end of the day, it's just an application where committee chairman will put in the calendar, and they'll be able to see where the members on their committees have overlapping obligations. And it's just a step to say, if you schedule it at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, 63% of your committee has a conflict. If you do it at 11, 43% has a conflict. So that's just a step in the right direction. Eventually, I do think once we get it all in one place, we'll be able to start doing block scheduling. Generally speaking, certain people serve on certain types of committees versus others. You're not allowed to serve on a secondary committee if you're on an A committee. So we'll be able to find a way to block schedule. Every middle school in the country does it. So Congress can figure it out. But again, this is just the first step towards deconflicting the schedule to allow members to be in their chairs in committees and engage in meaningful dialogue. We don't defend our ideas here. We spend our 5 minutes speaking to the camera, and then we go do something else. You need to be able to answer questions about your ideas, defend your ideas, and be open to changing your ideas. That's how we can actually move the ball forward for the American people. Our objective is to engage in evidence-based policymaking in a collaborative manner from a position of mutual respect. We don't do that. And the recommendations we've made will facilitate that, and I think that's going to make a huge impact for the country.
I'm sure our viewers will be curious about proxy voting. Will it be allowed? Does your committee advocate for it, Congressman?
So I do not believe it will not be allowed next Congress. I think long term there's legitimate concerns surrounding people that are ill and or having children. I mean, so it's something that will be considered, but I think next Congress we will go back to no proxy voting. It's something that future Congresses can consider, but I do think that it has been interestingly abused. I mean, the number of people that are currently proxy voting, well, we won't get into that right now. But on both sides of the aisle, I will say that.
Okay.
It's all because of COVID.
All right. So, Congressman Kimmel, where are you on that issue?
Well, I thought it was appropriate during the COVID pandemic to enable people, if there's a legitimate public health concern, not to put themselves or others at risk. I think as we close out the pandemic, obviously the new majority is going to have to determine whether they think it's a time to end that or whether it's important to keep it. But I do think there was a real legitimate reason to establish it when you're in the middle of a global pandemic.
I want to talk about, you touched on this a little bit, fostering civil bipartisan governance in your recommendations. Offering a nonpartisan new member orientation is what you just talked about. Making new member orientation more comprehensive and promoting civility during the new member orientation. So, Congressman Timmons, to you on this, is that happening?
It is, and we've had incredible reviews from the freshmen coming in. There was an event just Monday night where it was bipartisan and everybody got a chance to get to know one another, and it was very well received. And in addition to orientation, we have made a lot of recommendations surrounding physical space in the Capitol. It's challenging to find a neutral ground to actually engage in policy discussions with your colleagues across the aisle. And it's incredibly challenging just to break bread. And it should be very easy for a group of members to sit down and have a meal on the Hill after votes, we are making strides in that regard. Just Tuesday night, we had a civility dinner at the Library of Congress. It was incredible. Amanda Ripley was our speaker. We had 40-plus members, probably 100 people overall, and we spent 2 hours together talking about the institution, talking about the challenges we face, and getting to know one another. And I just think it's really challenging to be mean to each other on Twitter if you know one another and if you're going to work together on something. And look, I've always said I've been in elected office for 6 years now, and just because I can't work with somebody on one issue doesn't mean I won't work with them on another. And I've always found that the more people pushing the ball forward, the better off we're going to be.
Congressman Kilmer?
Well, I want to mention two other recommendations we made in this space, just because they're different, right? One, we made a recommendation that committees at the beginning of a Congress actually do bipartisan planning retreats, where the members of that committee can sit down and say, hey, what do we want to get done? I have never been part of an institution until I got to Congress that didn't define success at the beginning of a process. When I got to Congress, I was kind of amazed that doesn't happen. We did that on our committee. We actually got a nice room at the Library of Congress. We sat around a table. We started off by trying to get to know each other a little bit and asked the question, you know, what brought you to Congress and how has it met or failed to meet your expectations? And what I think would be interesting to your viewers is, you know, if you were a fly on the wall of that conversation, I'm not sure people would know who the Democrats were and who the Republicans were. There was a real desire to say, man, I'm bummed that the institution that I'm now serving in has, you know, lower approval ratings than had lice colonoscopies in the rock band Nickelback, right? Like, that's our real problem. And so having those bipartisan planning retreats, I think, is important. We made another recommendation that, again, doesn't seem like a big deal, but I think could change up the incentives. And that is to allow, when a bill is introduced, when a person of each party works on that bill, for there to be two lead sponsors of the bill. You know, right now, I mean, I had a campaign finance reform bill that I worked on a couple Congresses back, and I worked on it really diligently with one of my Republican colleagues. We spent hours together and our staffs together working on this legislation to land on something that could get support from both Democrats and Republicans. When we introduced the bill, we literally flipped a coin to see whose name would be on the bill, which seems stupid, right? Like, I think most people say, like, well, gosh, if it's a joint project, it should be something that both members can, in essence, own. And so that was one of our recommendations, is to allow two people to lead a bill. And I think that's going to be an important step, just a minor change in incentives that could make a real difference.
That was Democratic Congressman Derek Kilmer and Republican William Timmons, chair and ranking member on the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. Next, a discussion on the upcoming fiscal deadlines facing Congress and the history of lame duck Congresses pushing through big ticket spending bills.
A focus on federal spending now with Jonathan Bidlack of the R Street Institute. He's a program director there, the government's program. Previously helped found the Coalition to Reduce Spending and recently penned this piece for the National Review. Get ready for a big spending lame duck. Jonathan Bidlack, what are we likely to be spending big on in this upcoming lame duck?
Well, what aren't we likely to be spending big on, I guess, is the better question. I mean, look, it's sort of become, I think, this annual process where Congress doesn't finish, having their appropriations bills done on time. And so we tend to have an omnibus piece of legislation that sort of rolls them all together during the lame duck. That's, I think, what everyone is expecting this time around, obviously. Congress, basically approved funding for the government through December 16th. And so there's a need to basically either pass a continuing resolution that will extend it into the new Congress or to try to go and have some sort of omnibus piece of legislation. There are all sorts of other things. I mean, we haven't finished the National Defense Authorization Act, for example. So there's a lot of work being done on the defense budget for the coming year. And there's a lot of lobbying going on from both special interests outside Washington, but also just from the Pentagon itself, wanting to have an increase in their funding. So, and then there's all sorts of other priorities, the Electoral Count Act reforms. We saw the same-sex marriage bill yesterday. So there's a lot of things that I think Congress has been putting off that now they're sort of all cramming into this quickly shortening lame duck period.
In terms of an omnibus, what kind of price tag are we talking about here if that's what does come together?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big wild card. I don't know that anyone knows at this point. Obviously, it's to fund the entire government. So typically speaking, there will be some significant increase. You have a lot of government departments that are obviously, we're in an inflationary environment. So they're basically lobbying for increases in their budgets, perhaps even bigger than usual. So I think it will likely be large. Now, if they can't get a deal, if the president can't get a deal, then the talk is that he'll potentially support a continuing resolution through the entire year, which is something that hasn't typically been done. And that's where you're getting some of this pushback from, you know, the Defense Department in particular.
And the pushback is the Defense Department saying we can't respond to priorities that come up if we're working under the budget that was approved last time. Department heads of different agencies make the same argument that continuing resolutions tie their hands. What's your view of a continuing resolution?
You know, I think it's a little bit of maybe a full of sound and fury, signifying nothing, if you will. I think that, you know, first of all, there's a lot of funding that's available for multi-years, and many of the larger programs that the DoD in particular goes and funds, they're not reliant on sort of the funding they get on an annual basis. They have pools of money that are more appropriate. So, you know, and frankly, the GAO did a report, I think about a year and a half ago now, that looked at, you know, does DoD suffer under continuing resolutions, and they found no examples of any programs at DoD that that were sort of put on the back burner because of the fact they weren't getting reliable funding. I mean, the reality is we have continuing resolutions pretty much, again, you know, every year. So it's not like this is some sort of new process that they haven't been able to plan for. So I think when you combine the evidence from GAO with the fact that this has become sort of a regular occurrence, it makes me think that this is not really a legitimate concern.
This time, after a new Congress is elected, but before they're seated, the lame duck, usually a time for big spending. Is this unusual that this would be a big spending lame duck?
No, and it's become, I think, the norm. You know, I mean, obviously, we passed the 20th Amendment in the 1930s as a way of kind of cutting down on the lame duck period. I mean, if you recall, the Constitution says that, you know, inauguration date, I think, is March 4th. And so, you know, we basically took 2 months off of that since we no longer have people, you know, traveling from California, I guess, you know, in old forms of transportation. But the goal then was to reduce the lame duck period for this exact reason, that you tend to get policies where there's a little bit less accountability because you just had the election. You know, it's 2 years. A lot happens in 2 years where voters sort of forget what may have happened in the lame duck. And so so it's become this time where perhaps on the potentially good end, you can do things that there might otherwise not be the political will to do, you know, things like the ECA reform that I mentioned. But the other problem is that you end up having a lot of these big spending priorities where basically everyone can kind of go and, you know, get their hands in the cookie jar and increase spending in a way that they otherwise might not be able to.
When a chamber of Congress changes hands, what's the incentive for the party that's coming into power mm-hmm. to agree to big spending in a lame duck?
Well, right. I mean, so right now, obviously, Democrats have the majority, right, and they're losing the House. And so from their end, it's quite obvious, right? They want to get all of these priorities.
Right, but from the Republican end.
Right, and that's why you're hearing, I think, a lot of the messaging on the Republican side. But there are still certain things that Republicans do want to see funded, right? The DoD budget is a good example of that since we're talking about that. So there are these kinds of priorities. And then there are other things where I think there is just a diversity of opinion within the Republican Party in this case. You know, again, the Electoral Count Act, right, which isn't a spending bill, but it's something that there are people on the Republican side of the aisle who want to go and see that reform be passed. And so this is an enticing time to kind of take up a reform like that. And so I think the same thing goes on the spending front, that there are certain things, right, there are always priorities that both parties want. And frankly, when you look at their spending records or what they vote for, there's actually a lot more bipartisanship than you might think. I mean, the reality is that both parties, you know, to pass pretty much anything these days, you generally have to have some level of bipartisanship, especially when Congress is so close in margin. So, you know, there's a lot more agreement, I think, than sometimes we're led to believe.
That was Jonathan Bidlack from the R Street Institute. Next, we'll hear from Kiera Johnson, Executive Director of the National LGBTQ Task Force. She discusses this week's vote in the Senate on protecting same-sex and interracial marriages.
First, on the Respect for Marriage Act, what exactly does this legislation do?
Basically, what this does is it makes sure that those who have gotten married are, you know, that right is respected at the federal level and at the state level. So it's government recognition and acknowledgement of marriages between all people, including same-sex folks.
How does it do that?
It creates an opportunity for interstate recognition. It creates an opportunity for, if the Supreme Court overturns, for example, Obergefell or Windsor, it puts a protection in place that says, regardless of what happens, these marriages are protected.
And then another component of this is that it repeals the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act. You mentioned Obergefell. Didn't that overturn the Defense of Marriage Act?
It didn't overturn it, but it basically made it inoperable. And we know that things that we don't expect to happen, like overturns, like Dobbs, actually can happen at the Supreme Court level. So this is basically insurance to ensure that if the Supreme Court does decide to try to go there, that these marriages and these families are protected.
If the Supreme Court were to decide to go there and the Respect for Marriage Act was not signed into law or passed, what would happen if this was something that went to the states?
Well, at that point, the states decide whether or not they're going to allow marriages between two same gender loving people and whether or not they're going to recognize those, right? And without this, without the Respect for Marriage Act, it would mean that these marriages wouldn't be respected. So the benefits that come with marriage would not be accessible to those couples.
A lot of the conversation around on the Senate floor about this was about religious liberty protections. Explain what those were about.
Yeah, some of the amendments that were offered, they were defeated precisely because there is already language in the Respect for Marriage Act that protects religious freedom. It doesn't change any constitutional rights related to religious freedom. And so I think that's why we saw so much support for this bill in the first place, and why we saw so many defeat these amendments along the way.
This bill passed on the Senate floor 61-36, 12 Republicans joining Democrats to pass this legislation. This was Senator Chuck Schumer on the floor talking about this legislation.
So today's vote is deeply personal for many of us in this chamber. It's personal for me, of course. It's personal to many of my colleagues and their staff and their families. And while we still have a few more votes to take, today is certainly an occasion for joy and relief. But as important as today is, let's remember nothing about this process was certain. Remember, Mr. President, remember, it was our original plan to act on the Respect for Marriage Act in September, shortly after the House voted to pass this bill over the summer, with a surprising 47 Republicans voting for the act. We knew this bill was popular. We knew it was the right thing to do. But what we did not know was whether or not we had enough support, 60 votes, to pass this bill through the Senate. Maybe the votes would materialize if we forced a vote on the floor, but that was highly unlikely. And for a great number of us, for so much of America, this bill was too important to risk failure. So back in September, when I met with the leaders of this bill in my office, Senators Sinema and Baldwin and Collins and Tillis and Portman, they recommended I hold off on a vote because they believed they could secure enough support for this bill. Many questioned if it was the right thing to do. Many, on my side of the aisle, felt put everyone on record right now. And sometimes they say that's the way to go. But at the end of the day, my number one priority is always to get legislation passed through the Senate. So I made the decision to take the risk and to wait. Today, we have vindication. The wait was well worth it. Pushing Respect for Marriage over the finish line required patience, persistence, and today it's paying off.
Senator Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor yesterday. He said a few more votes to take. Explain what the process is for the Respect for Marriage Act from here on out.
Yeah, we're basically waiting for this bill to go to the House, which we've got our fingers crossed and a whole bunch of prayers going up in hopes to see the House also pass this bill. Once that happens, it goes to the president. So we're getting there. We're right there.
Keira Johnson is our guest, the executive director of the National LGBTQ Task Force. Explain what the task force is, how long you've been around.
Sure. The task force will be 50 years old next year. We are the largest advocacy activist organization in the nation, and we work to further the civil and human rights of LGBTQ people across the country.
That was Keira Johnson, executive director of the National LGBTQ Task Force. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.